From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now, and let's get right to those comments from Donald Trump that are causing so much controversy. Yesterday at a rally in Wilmington, North Carolina, he said this.
Hillary wants to essentially abolish the Second Amendment. By the way, and if she gets to pick her judges, nothing you can do, folks. Although the Second Amendment people, maybe there is, I don't know.
Well, Hillary Clinton's campaign responded with a statement that said what Trump is saying is dangerous. A person seeking to be president of the United States should not suggest violence in any way. We're joined by NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, what Trump said he would say, or people that are defending him today are saying it's ambiguous, but there are also Republicans and Democrats taking issue with it. What are people saying?
People are saying that here we go again, Jeremy, another off-the-cuff remark, sometimes referred to as, if that is the case, then perhaps that particular cuff should be changed and Donald Trump should stop reading off of it. Watch for those words, by the way, because it seems to signal that he's going to depart from his prepared remarks, and those prepared remarks are usually more measured, and then suddenly make some sort of an observation that is meant to respond to the crowd or goad the crowd a little bit. And in this instance, and we just heard the tape, everyone can hear the tape, watch the video, and ask themselves, what is he implying here? If his campaign is saying it's ambiguous, if people defending him are saying it's ambiguous, that's not a very strong defense, because if you admit it's ambiguous, you are saying there is a potential interpretation that would be a call to action or perhaps a call to arms to suggest that Second Amendment people, meaning people who are gun owners who believe in their gun rights and are very exercised about them, should do something at the point where Hillary Clinton was appointing judges, not just vote against her. We assume that that will be a strong vote against her from that community, but something at the point where she is appointing judges, which would, of course, imply she was already president.
Well, and let's listen to what Trump had to say about this last night on Fox News' show Hannity.
This is a tremendous political movement. The NRA, as you know, endorsed me. They're terrific people, Wayne and Chris and all of the people over there. And by the way, they've already, I just saw, they tweeted out, basically, they agree 100% with what I said. And there can be no other interpretation. Even reporters have told me. I mean, give me a break.
So he says there can be no other interpretation. I want to ask about something else that he said there, not the part that's getting all the attention, but what he said right before, which is that Hillary Clinton wants to abolish the Second Amendment. Has she said anything like that?
You know, this has been bouncing around for quite some time. So let's go at it directly. PolitiFact and every other fact-checking organization has been responding to this line from Donald Trump, which we've heard for months. And no one has ever been able to find a statement from her to the effect that she wants to abolish or essentially abolish or rescind or repeal the Second Amendment. What she has said is she believes in the Second Amendment. She supports Second Amendment rights. She supports people's right to bear arms. But she also believes in a common sense approach to it, and she has disagreed with the last Supreme Court decision, which was a 5-4 decision that threw out the handgun ban in the District of Columbia in Washington, D.C. And that, some people on the gun rights side, NRA people say, means that because she feels that there can be an infringement on somebody's rights to own a gun or a particular kind of gun in one particular city, that she does not truly believe in the Second Amendment.
Now, Thomas Friedman wrote in the New York Times today that there are striking similarities between Trump's language and the kind of language that the right-wing opponents of Israeli Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin used back in the 90s, and Rabin was assassinated. Is the language really that dangerous, what Trump has said?
We don't want to know. We don't want to find out how dangerous the language might be, because while it can be read as a call to action or a call to arms, you know, it could also be in somebody's mind a suggestion to an individual. Donald Trump has said that was not his intention. Everyone in his campaign has said that is not his intention. And what, of course, Thomas Friedman is writing is that it doesn't matter at some level what you're intending. There is such a thing as a implicit permission. There is a tacit signal to a certain kind of sick individual, and you don't want to get anywhere near that.
Now, Hillary Clinton has been out of the news, it seems, for days. She is going to be giving an economic speech tomorrow. But this is distracting again from something that the Trump campaign would love to have the media focus on, which is new emails coming out. Anything going on the Hillary side that we should be talking about, Ron?
Yes, there are new emails from people at the Clinton Foundation to the State Department while Hillary Clinton was the Secretary of State. And of course, the Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton Foundation was set up by the Clintons to raise a lot of money to support some of their causes around the world. And some of the people who gave money to that foundation had agendas before the State Department. They were people from other countries, billionaires from other countries, and they asked for favors. And some of those favor requests seem to have been passed on from the Clinton Foundation people to the State Department. Now, whether or not there was any action taken on any of them or whether they were about setting up meetings, we still don't know. We've just seen a smattering of these emails, but those are the issues being raised.
That's Ron Elving, NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent. Ron, thanks as always.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Now to a story out of Washington, D.C. WikiLeaks is adding fuel to a firestorm of online speculation about the recent murder of 27-year-old Seth Rich. Now, Seth Rich worked for the DNC, the Democratic National Committee. He was killed July 10th in what D.C. police say was a failed robbery. But there's been wild online speculation that he was killed because he worked for the DNC, that he may have been helping the FBI expose party wrongdoing, or that he might even have been the one who leaked those recent embarrassing emails that 2 weeks after his death forced out party chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz. And now WikiLeaks is offering $20,000 in reward for information that leads to a conviction in the case. Patrick Madden is a senior reporter at WAMU. And Patrick, start with what are police saying is true about Seth Rich's murder?
Right. So, Robin, this is an unsolved murder right now. And here's what we know. Seth Rich was a 27-year-old staffer at the Democratic National Committee. And early one morning around 4:50, he was shot and killed outside his home in Bloomingdale, which is a neighborhood in D.C. And police say, as you mentioned, that they believe this was a robbery attempt gone wrong. And he was shot twice in the back. His wallet and watch were not taken. And last week, Rich's parents and the police chief held a press conference near where this all happened, and they're trying to appeal for witnesses to come forward. But right now, this is an unsolved murder, one of 80 that have happened this year. But just to reiterate the point, police believe that this was a robbery and that the neighborhood where this happened was having, you know, a real sharp uptick in attempted armed robberies.
Right. But the fact that nothing was taken is what partly fueled this. But what else did it? I mean, he developed computer programs that helped people find their voting precincts. These rumors came before the WikiLeaks leak. So what was behind this? Do we know?
These are conspiracy theories that are sort of bubbling up online right now. And so I'm not sure when they started happening. Obviously, it happened before this right. WikiLeaks offer. But if you look at them, they're sort of all over the place. Some say he was, you know, helping WikiLeaks. Others say he was helping the FBI or that the Clintons involved. I mean, again, these are all internet rumors that are unsubstantiated. And clearly, this WikiLeaks offer is helping ramp up this.
Right,
and
because the fact is that it is making people think, as Seth Rich's father has said, that they're, you know, you're fueling the idea that there is a connection between WikiLeaks and my son. Now, in a statement, WikiLeaks editor Julian Assange said he would not confirm or deny whether Rich was a source. He said, "We treat threats towards any suspected WikiLeaks sources with extreme gravity, but that shouldn't be taken to imply that Seth Rich was a source." But it is. Why doesn't Julian Assange just say he wasn't?
Right. I mean, obviously, this statement or this offer by WikiLeaks is really helping fan the flames here. And it's implying that somehow, some way, you know, Rich's death is tied to this, tied to what's happening with WikiLeaks. And of course, you know, Rich's parents have come out and said they were that they've been offended by these bizarre reports circulating. And while, you know, they appreciate this money if it does help, you know, find the killer or killers here, I think they're certainly dismayed by the implications of this offer. And again, you know, the police actually had to put out a statement in response to WikiLeaks yesterday saying that, you know, as of right now, there's nothing in their investigation that suggests that his death had anything to do with his job at the DNC.
Yeah, and before she stepped down, DNC Chair Debbie Wasserman Schultz attended a vigil for Rich in front of his home. Again, this was a couple weeks before the emails came out. Before she was nominated, Hillary Clinton evoked his name in a speech in which she called for limiting the availability of guns. What is the DNC saying anything now?
Well, they're not saying anything right now specifically, you know, in response to this WikiLeaks offer, although they have been, you know, supportive of, you know, Rich's family. They've talked about, you know, what a great employee he was. Debbie Wasserman Schultz, before she stepped down, you know, came out to one of the vigils that was held in this neighborhood. So, you know, they haven't directly responded to this WikiLeaks announcement. And, of course, that may be that they don't want to just, you know,
add fuel to it.
Keep this, add fuel to the fire.
Well, and Assange says he doesn't confirm or deny anything ever. But you'd think you'd let this young man rest in peace if you could. Patrick Madden, senior reporter at WAMU in Washington, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
One person was seriously injured in Ferguson, Missouri last night after a car ran through a peaceful demonstration marking the second anniversary of the killing of Michael Brown. A police spokesman told the St. Louis Post-Dispatch that police don't believe the driver intentionally struck the protester, but there was gunfire reported afterward. The 18-year-old Michael Brown was shot and killed by a white police officer 2 years ago, and the decision by prosecutors not to indict the officer responsible for the shooting, Darren Wilson, sparked riots and protests in Ferguson and around the country. Back in 2014, when the news first broke about the shooting, St. Louis DJ Jacole Dolby, also known as Boogie D, stopped playing music at Hot 104.1 and opened the phone lines to the Ferguson community. We checked in with him back then, and he joins us again right now. Boogie D, welcome back.
Well, thank you, Jeremy. I appreciate it.
And first of all, what do you make of this incident with the pedestrian being struck by a car at the protest on the anniversary of the shooting?
Until we get all the details, the last I heard, they didn't really have the full story of what happened. They did say that the person that was driving the car did pull over. The cops were able to talk to that person and get their side of the story, which I haven't heard this morning when I looked at the update on the story. It was still just the story of the car had, kind of ran through the protesting and then somebody shot at the car.
Yeah, and we'll obviously keep an eye on that and see what details come out. Now, when we spoke to you in November of 2014, after the decision was announced to not charge Officer Darren Wilson with the killing of Michael Brown, there was a lot of anger in the community. There was looting and rioting. And you asked the question, where do we go from here? So 2 years later, what do you think? And how's the community doing?
Well, I would say that everybody is still waiting to see what's really going to happen transpire. Now, we know there's been, almost a complete overhaul of the Ferguson Police Department and the judicial system over there. So I always say that people are still watching this see as things continue to move. As we know, things of this nature move very slowly. I think we still here in St. Louis and in the Ferguson area are still, you know, feeling like things aren't 100% settled, 100%, how should we put it, okay. I think that as you can see last night on the anniversary, everything was peaceful. It wasn't the protesters that were causing any problems. And then something happens where somebody kind of barrels through with a car, shots ring out. You know, some protesters did go over to the Muni. The Muni was having a performance. That's an outdoor venue in Forest Park where they have plays. And, you know, they protest a little bit over there. But mostly everything was been peaceful. So I guess that question is, we're still kind of seeing how what happens. I think for most part in the last 2 years, Ferguson has been as normal can be.
Well, you mentioned the overhaul in the police department and in the city. There's a new police chief and city manager, both of whom are black, four new city council members. There's been a changeover in a lot of the police force. Do you think the relationship between the police and the people in the African-American community there has improved?
Well, I can only, since I don't live in Ferguson, that would not be for me to answer that. I do go to Ferguson a lot. You know, one of my favorite hangouts, my cigar bar is right in Ferguson and literally right next to the Ferguson Police Department. I can say that it seems every time I'm in, you know, over there on Saturdays, everything seems fine as far as I don't see an abundance of police pulling people over. I don't feel a certain way when I'm over in the area or anything like that. But I don't live there directly to say how things have changed since Michael Brown was killed. I think that it's been an effort throughout St. Louis police and the community that we're more heightened and aware of when anything happens. I think that's where we are. And then seeing what's been going on in the country, we very much understand how people feel when you see things that happen in Baton Rouge or Minnesota or things like, or even the tragic happening in Dallas with police officers being targeted. I think we all here in St. Louis, you know, sympathize to a point, but we still want things to get right, fixed here, right.
Do you feel like Ferguson and St. Louis, though, are in a different position than some of the other places that you mentioned that have dealt with police shootings of African-Americans because Ferguson was really the first one to capture the national attention?
I think right now where we're at, we have things that, like as you said, we have things that are now in place. We have different leadership. Now we have to see how that bears out with numbers and statistics. Do we see what came out in the initial Department of Justice report about how the policing was pretty much, you know, it was a lot of tickets. You know, we call it the ticket scam. You know, they would basically, they ticket you for everything. They nickel and dime you for every little thing. We had to see that play out in a different report to come out and say, has things really changed?
Well, we do know that the revenue for that kind of thing in Ferguson has dropped dramatically.
So there you go. And then I think that goes a long way to showing other cities how we can start to get the dialogue going. I do know that police in this area, especially in Ferguson, have reached out more to the community to try to be more in the community. Now, has the community responded? We still see on that front.
Do you think that as we head towards the election this year that police reform is going to be on the minds of people in St. Louis and Ferguson?
I think it's on everybody's mind throughout the entire country. I think, honestly, we all realize that it's not just a Ferguson problem or a St. Louis problem. It's been a problem for the entire country for a long time. So I think that we all here and across the nation, is we all wanted to figure out how to make it better. We all understand that, you know, anybody with common sense understands we need the police. You know, so it's not a question of to demonize every police officer. We just all want to be treated equally and with respect when we encounter law enforcement, even for a traffic stop.
That's DJ Boogie D at Hot 104.1 in St. Louis, joining us as we mark this week the second anniversary of the shooting of Michael Brown by police officer Darren Wilson there in Ferguson. Boogie D, thanks so much.
No, thank you guys. I appreciate it.
Well, in Washington, D.C. this summer, young people of color are using the stage to express concerns over race-related violence. They're learning theater skills in a performing arts program called Paso Nuevo, or New Step. Armando Truel from Here and Now contributor WAMU reports.
I'm female. I'm black. I'm a woman. I'm mixed.
About a dozen teens are standing on the stage of the Gala Theater in Washington, D.C. They're rehearsing for a performance that's a culmination of all they've learned during their summer performing arts camp.
Right here, where she's talking about the government, how the police is treating them, you have to sound more angry and more frustrated.
14-year-old Nathan Robinson is directing one of the actresses in a play he wrote. It's about society's apathy over violence, especially when it's directed by police at people of color. He says he chose this issue because it's very much in the news and on the minds of many in his neighborhood.
It doesn't feel like they have justice when the police officer that did do the crime is able to walk. And so I wanted to give voice to them.
Robinson says he has lived in D.C. all his life, in neighborhoods that are safe and some that are not so safe.
When you become immune to hearing that someone died, looking at gunshots, somebody getting shot in the blood on the ground, they just fall and then you're like, oh, there it goes again. And how people would just resort to violence as the first thing. I find that as being monstrous. You say that
Nobody can build a better wall than you, but I am pretty sure that the Chinese wouldn't say that's true.
15-year-old Felicia Miranda is playing the ukulele and singing a song she wrote in response to comments from Republican presidential nominee Donald Trump. She says his remarks about Mexicans and immigrants scare her and her friends.
He says a lot of things that are demeaning or, like, rude towards people of color.
Miranda believes Trump represents a brand of discrimination found in some segments of society.
Immigrants and people of color in general, like, just we have so much to contribute to American society, and there's a lot that's, like, being swept under the rug. People don't realize it, and they, like, discriminate and oppress, like, us as a community.
Quique Avilés is the Paso Nuevo Artistic Director. He says he's heard this and other similar themes from the young people this summer.
I think there's a feeling amongst themselves that they're not liked, you know, because of the color of their skin. And that's what's permeated the dialogue throughout the summer, and that is what they're writing about, and that is what the show's about.
Paso Nuevo is part of the mayor's Summer Youth Employment Program, which helps young people develop professional skills. The teens earn $5.25 an hour for their participation. Budding playwright Nathan Robinson says the money is important to him.
I can give my mom $10 or $20 because I want to show her my appreciation.
But he's also glad to be learning how to influence an audience through his writing.
I want to have them feel as though change will come and have people actually take action before that can happen.
For Here and Now, I'm Armando Truhl.
Support for Here and Now and the following message comes from Blue Apron, helping make delicious home-cooked meals by sourcing from artisanal suppliers, family-run farms, fisheries, and ranchers. Whether it's Japanese ramen noodles, wild-caught Alaskan salmon, or heirloom tomatoes, you choose from a range of recipes that can be made in 40 minutes or less. Pre-measured ingredients delivered to your door only when you want. Check out this week's menu and get 3 meals free with free shipping by going to blueapron.com/here. New recipes are created each week. That's blueapron.com/here.
And now to a drama rivaling Shakespeare in a Pennsylvania courtroom. The state's AG, Kathleen Kane, is on trial, accused of leaking secret grand jury documents to a newspaper to show that former prosecutor Frank Fina bungled a high-profile case. The state says it was revenge because Kane suspected Fina of planting a previous article alleging she botched an investigation, which could have been Fina's revenge for her criticism of his investigation of Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky, who was ultimately convicted of child abuse. What a tangled web indeed. Katie Culinary is with our contributing station, WHYY. And Katie, Prosecutor Michelle Henry's first words in this trial were, "Revenge is best served cold." She said she was quoting the accused, A.G. Kane. What exactly is Kane accused of doing? She's not being accused of handing over the documents to the paper herself.
Right, exactly. She is accused of orchestrating the leak of these secret documents and lying about it under oath to cover it up. And again, prosecutors say she simply did it to get revenge on Fina, the prosecutor who investigated but didn't charge Jerry Mondesire, the former head of the Philadelphia NAACP, who died last year.
Right. I mean, there's just all these cases that are, you know, people in Pennsylvania are very well aware of, but how it spills out onto the national stage is a very ugly political fight. Remind us how it got started.
Right. So you mentioned at the top that there's sort of these dueling newspaper articles, and one appeared in the Philadelphia Inquirer 3 months before the Daily News article that Kane is said to have orchestrated by releasing these secret documents. So that Philadelphia Inquirer article in March 2014 was about how Kane declined to pursue criminal charges against Democratic state lawmakers who were caught taking gifts from an undercover operative. And that was really the first bit of bad press she got since she was elected the state's first female attorney general.
Well, from Scranton, a hometown. Yeah.
Right,
yeah.
Exactly. And she was considered a Democratic rising star. And so this really made her angry. This is war, she said in an email to a political consultant that was presented as evidence in the trial yesterday. And prosecutors say she blamed FINA for putting that story out into the press to embarrass her. Of course, her defense team is disputing that idea of any feud, and her lead attorney said yesterday she didn't care one whit about the guy.
And are people buying that? I mean, you know, most states have these political fights that go on behind the scenes. Are people buying that, oh, he left office a few hours after she came in or a few days after she came, she really didn't know about him?
Right. That's an interesting question, because there's actually been, you know, of course, a lot of reporting in the press. What their relationship really was, only those two and maybe those close to them really know. But there have been multiple reports in the press of a lot of animosity between Kane and FINA, and between Kane and other prosecutors, that, you know, because she ran on this idea that under Corbett, all these guys didn't really do their jobs.
Well, so now you have a sitting AG whose law license is revoked because of part of this is perjury charges. She's had to delegate work to subordinates. We just have a few seconds, but how are people feeling about this? This is their AG.
None of this has been good for her or the attorney general's office. There's been report after report about how dysfunctional the office has gotten, and she's gone through something like 6 different spokespeople in the last year or so. The last one quit because he said he could no longer explain the inexplicable. In the meantime, she's resisted calls to step down.
Well, and the trial is expected to last through the end of the week. We'll keep an eye on it with WHYY reporter Katie Culinary. Thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, let's go back in time now for a summer oldies edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions.
Summer loving had me a blast.
Trees swaying in the summer breeze.
In the summertime, when the weather is hot, you can stretch right up and touch the sky.
Joining us now is Mike Hale, a.k.a. Mike in the Morning, my favorite childhood DJ. He is general manager at WHMS in Champaign, Illinois. Mike, great to have you back with us once again.
Hey, thanks for having me again. This is I love the opportunity. The neat thing is I hear from so many of your listeners across the country who used to live here at one time or another. And when I tell them we now have 22-story high-rises in the middle of campus, they're like, you're kidding.
It's a different town these days in Champaign,
it
Urbana.
Is.
Well, let's get to some of this music. Great songs from the past. This is 1964's Under the Boardwalk by The Drifters.
Under the boardwalk, down by the sea, on a blanket with my baby's where I'll be.
Under the boardwalk,
out of the sun.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be having some fun.
Under the boardwalk,
people walking about.
Under the boardwalk,
we'll be making love
under the boardwalk,
boardwalk.
Now, this song was chosen recently by Rolling Stone magazine as one of the 500 best songs of all time. Tell us more about it.
This is just another great little romance song. The Drifters did not want to record this particular song. In fact, Jerry Wexler, who was the head of Atlantic Records at the time, heard the composition, saw the, and he goes, you guys have got to record this. A group kind of drugged their feet on it. So they scheduled a recording date, and the lead singer of the Drifters, Rudy Lewis, the night before they were to record the song, died. So they kept the recording session in place the next day, brought in Johnny Moore, who had been the lead vocalist for the Drifters earlier in their career, and recorded the song, and it is a terrific, just so simple recording.
And when I think of the Drifters, they've had a number of songs, including their famous version of White Christmas.
Excellent. Oh, great record. In fact, the Drifters, on the song There Goes My Baby in 1959, were the first group to use violins in a top 10 song.
Wow. Well, let's get to the next one that you brought us. This is Dancing in the Street. People know this one. It's by Martha Reeves and the Vandellas.
Summer's here and the time is right for dancing in the street.
Now, people may not be surprised to hear that Marvin Gaye was actually one of the writers of this song.
Yeah, one of the three writers of the song. The Funk Brothers are the studio group, and the Funk Brothers do an awesome job on every piece of music. The great thing about this song is it's been re-recorded. Van Halen's had a hit with it. David Bowie and Mick Jagger did a duet with
it.
The Grateful Dead started doing this in concert back in 1969. They would do a 15 to 20 minute version. This is one of those evergreen records that never sounds dated.
And author Mark Kurlansky has written an entire book about this song and how it became an anthem in the civil rights movement.
You know, and Martha Reeves was asked about that several times when she toured back in the 60s and 70s, especially in Europe. And she says, hey, it's just a party song.
Well, we cannot talk about songs of summer without this next one, which is Summertime Blues from 1958 by Eddie Cochran. Here it is.
I'm a gonna raise a fuss, I'm a gonna raise a holler about a working all summer just to try to earn a dollar.
No dice, son, you gotta work late.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime.
Now, Mike, I am sure that you have never seen this movie, but the movie that I associate with this song is the movie Camp Nowhere, which came out when I was a kid. And we watched it over and over and over again. All these kids, they don't want to go to the camps that their parents have sent them to, so they take all the money they would have spent and get their own camp. But anyway, that's what I associate with this. But tell us about this song.
I'm just writing this down. Camp Nowhere.
Camp Nowhere.
I've never seen this movie.
It wasn't very highly acclaimed. So I wouldn't even bother, but it was fun to watch.
You know, what's interesting about this song, it's 1958, and up until this time, every summer song that had been recorded had had romance in it or how great summer was. This was the first rock and roll song that talked about the hardships of summer.
Meaning what?
That, you know, couldn't get a job, just, you know, things were tough. And where else but in this song is the word congressman in the lyrics of the song, and actually get some rhyming out of it.
Well, I called my congressman and he said, quote,
I'd like to help you, son, but you're too young to vote.
Sometimes I wonder what I'm gonna do, but there ain't no cure for the summertime blues.
Well, the next one that we've got here is from 1966, and it is a song that I guess you could associate with summer, although I always think of the Beach Boys as people where it's summer all the time where they are out in California. But here is Good Vibrations.
I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me the excitations. I'm picking up good vibrations. She's giving me
Mike, how does this one stack up against the other Beach Boys songs? I mean, were they all sort of the same level of hit, or did this one stand out?
Oh, this is a masterpiece. This is, you know, you look up classic in the dictionary. This is a song you're going to see next to classic. This may be one of the best songs in the entire history of rock and roll.
Wow.
It's just every time you hear it, it just, you feel good. And you're right, it's not really a summer song, but it became a song that was associated with the summer of love. I think it means something different to everybody.
Well, and music theorists have said that it broke all the rules. What does that mean? Why is this song so different?
Well, I think what makes it really different is the amount of work, the 9 months that went into to putting this together, produced, obviously, and composed by Brian Wilson. Mike Love did the lyrics on this. But, you know, Brian Wilson was striving for perfection here. And it's a perfect song.
Why do you think that these songs from the 60s last until today?
I think simply they're just simple songs that express the feeling of summer. I think everybody has a, for the most part, a very positive feel about summer. And summer is supposed to be a simple time. You know, it's supposed to be when you unplug from the rest of the world. And I just think simple, innocent songs have stood, these songs have stood the test of time easily.
That's Mike Hale, a.k.a. Mike in the Morning at WHMS in Champaign, Illinois, where he is general manager. Mike, always great to have you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Look forward to seeing you back in Champaign sometime.
And you can hear all our DJ session picks on our Spotify playlist. That's on Spotify. Just search for NPR Here and Now. You can also find us on Apple Music or at hereandnow.org.
Medical marijuana is being accepted in states across the country, but at the federal level, not much has changed. It's illegal. And for some veterans who depend on the federal VA for their medical care, that's frustrating. So some are taking matters into their own hands, opting to use marijuana in addition to or instead of their prescriptions. From Santa Cruz, California, Alyssa Jung-Perry reports.
You're going to initial at each of those blank spots.
In a sleepy beach town in Northern California, over 70 veterans are clustered around picnic benches behind the local VFW because they're here to pick up some free marijuana.
You want all of it just so you can do it all together?
Okay. Let me see your blue ID.
One of the vets in attendance is Tom Evans, a 27-year-old Afghanistan war hero who has a Bronze Star Medal with Valor and a Purple Heart. Now he's a member of the Santa Cruz Veterans Alliance, SCVA. It's a grassroots veterans group that grows medical marijuana for local dispensaries.
Yeah, that's the retirement ID.
The SCVA donates twice a month to local veterans through their compassion program. Combat experiences can be so intense that they stay with vets for a long time. This is from one of the battles during Tom's last tour. It was in the heart of the Panjwai district of Afghanistan, where the Taliban regime rules. Tom's friend from his unit recorded this in 2012. Tom says firefights between his unit and the Taliban happened every day.
Hey, give him the floor. Get the floor.
One fateful mission sent him home after a bomb exploded right next to him.
Well, I got diagnosed with a traumatic brain injury. I have a bunch of facial injuries from when the IED went off. So I have a lot of sinus issues. I have nerve damage in my face. I have nerve damage in my legs and my arm. I have a broken L5 from the IED. And then I have a lot of wear and tear stuff, too. So I have both my knees are torn. My meniscuses are torn.
Now Tom has spent the last 2 years adjusting to civilian life, sort of trying to find a new normal.
How's it going? Good. I haven't been here in a couple months. But
many of the SCVA vets, like Tom, say that because of the VA's commonly prescribed cocktail of benzodiazepines and opiates, they didn't feel like themselves and have suffered from addiction, suicide attempts, or even overdoses. Tim Hinman is an Iraq war vet who attends the bi-monthly vets cannabis meetings. He says the cocktail of pills prescribed from the VA made him sick, blackout, and experienced traumatic flashbacks from combat. Now he's found a prescription that works for him.
I take normal like antidepressants or things like that, but I have to also use cannabis with that, or else I would need to be on a mood stabilizing anxiety medication. I also have to take some other medicine, but nothing in the category of that kind of stuff.
Another Iraq war vet, Rodney Rodenberg, was on painkillers and sleeping pills from the VA. He says it took him 6 months to wean off.
You know, being on those pills, you're pretty much on the couch, sleeping all the time. I can do everything I was doing before when I smoke.
So these vets have decided to take their medical treatment into their own hands by using marijuana. Dr. Anna Lemke is assistant professor at Stanford University's Medical Center. She specializes in addiction and pain management. She says that benzodiazepines are prescribed for anxiety and sleep issues. while opioids are prescribed for pain.
People can build up tolerance and dependence such that the medications don't work anymore after a time. And then if they try to stop the medications, they go into withdrawal. Particularly with benzodiazepines like Klonopin and Xanax, the withdrawal can actually be life-threatening. People can have full-on seizures and die.
Back at the SVA's Compassion Program, all these vets share their combat experiences.
That's purified water.
And they all talk about how cannabis treats their war trauma. In some states where marijuana is still illegal, vets say that their local VAs have denied them care. But Michael Hill Jackson, a spokesperson for the Palo Alto VA, says that each case is evaluated individually.
At the end of the day, we're always going to look at evidence-based medicine. Our providers are always going to do what's medically safe. So if the treatment plan is inconsistent with the use of marijuana, that will be between the provider and the patient.
But the VA, where many veterans receive medical care, follows the directive of the federal government. It says marijuana is a Schedule I drug. Think cocaine and heroin.
They just don't understand. So we're trying to educate. We're trying to show them that it's not just a recreational thing, but it's also a medical thing. And we are using this as a medicine. And the VA needs to recognize that. We are replacing our pharmaceuticals with medical cannabis, and it's a safer alternative.
That's Aaron Newsom, a Marine Corps vet and the co-founder of the SCVA. Because of cannabis, Tom says he doesn't have to take any prescription pills.
I just feel like we have a very skewed look at marijuana that we shouldn't. I feel like all these veteran suicides would go down. I feel like all these veteran abuse problems as far as alcohol and prescription drugs, and then moving on to harder drugs, which is what prescription drugs lead to, like heroin. I feel like that wouldn't happen as much if we were able to smoke marijuana.
For NPR News, I'm Alyssa Jung Perry in Santa Cruz, California.
And we're going to continue to follow the story of medical marijuana as it makes its way across the country to see the effects. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.